Chapter 10. The fair, the journey, the fire. 2 months passed away. We are brought on to a day in February, on which was held the yearly statute or hiring fair in the county town of Casterbridge. At one end of the street stood from 200 to 300 blithe and hardy laborers waiting upon chance, all men of the stamp to whom labor suggests nothing worse than a wrestle with gravitation, and pleasure nothing better than a renunciation of the same. Among these, carters and wagoners were distinguished by having a piece of whipcord twisted round their hats. Thatchers wore a fragment of woven straw. Shepherds held their sheep crooks in their hands. And thus the situation required was known to the hirers at a glance. In the crowd was an athletic young fellow of some what superior appearance to the rest. In fact, his superiority was marked enough to lead several ruddy peasants standing by to speak to him inquiringly as to a farmer, and to use "sir" as a finishing word. His answer always was, "I am looking for a place myself, a bailiff's. Do ye know of anybody who wants one?" Gabriel was paler now. His eyes were more meditative, and his expression was more sad. He had passed through an ordeal of wretchedness which had given him more than it had taken away. He had sunk from his modest elevation as pastoral king into the very slime pits of Siddim, but there was left to him a dignified calm he had never before known, and that indifference to fate which, though it often makes a villain of a man, is the basis of his sublimity when it does not. And thus the abasement had been exaltation, and the loss gain. In the morning a regiment of cavalry had left the town, and a sergeant and his party had been beating up for recruits through the four streets. As the end of the day drew on, and he found himself not hired, Gabriel almost wished that he had joined them, and gone off to serve his country. Weary of standing in the marketplace, and not much minding the kind of work he turned his hand to, he decided to offer himself in some other capacity than that of bailiff. All the farmers seemed to be wanting shepherds. Sheep tending was Gabriel's speciality. Turning down an obscure street and entering an obscure lane, he went up to a smith's shop. "How long would it take you to make a shepherd's crook?" "20 minutes." "How much?" "2 shillings. He sat on a bench and the crook was made, a stem being given him into the bargain. He then went to a ready-made clothes shop, the owner of which had a large rural connection. As the crook had absorbed most of Gabriel's money, he attempted, and carried out, an exchange of his overcoat for a shepherd's regulation smock frock. This transaction having been completed, he again hurried off to the center of the town, and stood on the curb of the pavement, as a shepherd, crook in hand. Now that Oak had turned himself into a shepherd, it seemed that bailiffs were most in demand. However, 2 or 3 farmers noticed him and drew near. Dialogues followed, more or less in the subjoined form. "Where do you come from?"
"Norcombe."
"That's a long way."
"15 miles.
Whose farm were you upon last?"
"My own."
This reply invariably operated like a rumor of cholera. The inquiring farmer would edge away and shake his head dubiously. Gabriel, like his dog, was too good to be trustworthy, and he never made advance beyond this point. It is safer to accept any chance that offers itself, and extemporize a procedure to fit it, than to get a good shepherd, but had laid himself out for anything in the whole cycle of labor that was required in the fair. It grew dusk. Some merry men were whistling and singing by the corn exchange. Gabriel's hand, which had lain for some time idle in his smock frock pocket, touched his flute which he carried there. Here was an opportunity for putting his dearly bought wisdom into practice. He drew out his flute, and began to play Aki to the fair in the style of a man who had never known moment's sorrow. Oak could pipe with Arcadian sweetness, and the sound of the well-known notes cheered his own heart as well as those of the loungers. He played on with spirit, and in half an hour had earned in pence what was a small fortune to a destitute man. By making inquiries he learned that there was another fair at Shottsford the next day. "How far is Shottsford?"
10 miles t'other side of Weatherbury. Weatherbury. It was where Bathsheba had gone 2 months before. This information was like coming from night into noon. How far is it to Weatherbury? 5 or 6 miles. Bathsheba had probably left Weatherbury long before this time, but the place had enough interest attaching to it to lead Oak to choose Shottsford Fair as his next field of inquiry, because it lay in the Weatherbury quarter. Moreover, the Weatherbury folk were by no means uninteresting intrinsically. If report spoke truly, they were as hearty, merry, thriving, wicked a set as any in the whole county. Oak resolved to sleep at Weatherbury that night on his way to Shottsford, and struck out at once into the high road which had been recommended as the direct route to the village in question. The road stretched through water meadows traversed by little brooks, whose quivering surfaces were braided along their centers, and folded in two creases at the sides. Or, where the flow was more rapid, the stream was pied with spots of white froth, which rode on in undisturbed serenity. On the higher levels the dead and dry carcasses of leaves tapped the ground as they bowled along helter-skelter upon the shoulders of the wind, and little birds in the hedges were rustling their feathers and tucking themselves in comfortably for the night, retaining their places if Oak kept moving, but flying away if he stopped to look at them. He passed by Yalberry Wood, where the game birds were rising to their roosts, and heard the crack-voiced cock pheasants uck, cuck, and the wheezy whistle of the hens. By the time he had walked 3 or 4 miles, every shape in the landscape had assumed a uniform hue of blackness. He descended Yalberry Hill, and could just discern ahead of him a wagon, drawn up under a great overhanging tree by the roadside. On coming close, he found there were no horses attached to it, the spot being apparently quite deserted. The wagon, from its position, seemed to have been left there for the night, for beyond about half a truss of hay which was heaped in the bottom, it was quite empty. Gabriel sat down on the shafts of the vehicle and considered his position. He calculated that he had walked a very fair proportion of the journey, and having been on foot since daybreak, he felt tempted to lie down upon the hay in the wagon instead of pushing on to the village of Weatherbury, and having to pay for a lodging. Eating his last slices of bread and ham, and drinking from the bottle of cider he had taken the precaution to bring with him, he got into the lonely wagon. Here he spread half of the hay as a bed, and, as well as he could in the darkness, pulled the other half over him by way of bedclothes, covering himself entirely, and feeling, physically, as comfortable as ever he had been in his life. Inward melancholy it was impossible for a man like Oak, introspective far beyond his neighbors, to banish quite, whilst conning the present, untoward page of his history. So, thinking of his misfortunes, amorous and pastoral, he fell asleep, shepherds enjoying, in common with sailors, the privilege of being able to summon the god instead of having to wait for him. On somewhat suddenly awaking after a sleep, of whose length he had no idea, Oak found that the wagon was in motion. He was being carried along the road at a rate rather considerable for a vehicle without springs, and under circumstances of physical uneasiness, his head being dandled up and down on the bed of the wagon like a kettle drum stick. He then distinguished voices in conversation, coming from the forepart of the wagon. His concern at this dilemma, which would have been alarm, had he been a thriving man, but misfortune is a fine opiate to personal terror, led him to peer cautiously from the hay, and the first sight he beheld was the stars above him. Charles's wane was getting towards a right angle with the pole star, and Gabriel concluded that it must be about 9 o'clock. In other words, that he had slept 2 hours. This small astronomical calculation was made without any positive effort, and whilst he was stealthily turning to discover, if possible, into whose hands he had fallen. Two figures were dimly visible in front, sitting with their legs outside the wagon, one of whom was driving. Gabriel soon found that this was the wagoner, and it appeared they had come from Casterbridge Fair, like himself. A conversation was in progress, which continued thus. Be asked Will, she's a fine handsome body as far as looks be concerned. But that's only the skin of the woman, and these dandy cattle be as proud as a Lucifer in their insides. A so a do seem, Billy Smallberry so a do seem. This utterance was very shaky by nature, and more so by circumstance, the jolting of the wagon not being without its effect upon the speaker's larynx. It came from the man who held the reins. She's a very vain famel, so 'tis said here and there. Ah, now. If so be 'tis like that, I can't look her in the face. Lord, no. Not I, Such a shy man as I be. Yes, she's very vain. 'Tis said that every night at going to bed she looks in the glass to put on her nightcap properly. And not a married woman. Oh, the world. And a can play the peener, so 'tis said. Can play so clever that a can make a psalm tune sound as well as the merriest loose song a man can wish for. Be it a lot. A happy time for us, and I feel quite a new man. And how do she play? That I don't know, Master Poorgrass. On hearing these and other similar remarks, a wild thought flashed into Gabriel's mind that they might be speaking of Bathsheba. There were, however, no ground for retaining such a supposition, for the wagon, though going in the direction of Weatherbury, might be going beyond it, and the woman alluded to seemed to be the mistress of some estate. They were now apparently close upon Weatherbury, and not to alarm the speakers unnecessarily, Gabriel slipped out of the wagon unseen. He turned to an opening in the hedge, which he found to be a gate, and mounting thereon, he sat meditating whether to seek a cheap lodging in the village, or to ensure a cheaper one by lying under some hay or corn stack. The crunching jangle of the wagon died upon his ear. He was about to walk on, when he noticed on his left hand an unusual light appearing about half a mile distant. Oak watched it, and the glow increased. Something was on fire. Gabriel again mounted the gate, and, leaping down on the other side upon what he found to be plowed soil, made across the field in the exact direction of the fire. The blaze, enlarging in a double ratio by his approach and its own increase, showed him as he drew nearer the outlines of ricks beside it, lighted up to great distinctness. A rickyard was the source of the fire. His weary face now began to be painted over with a rich orange glow, and the whole front of his smock frock and gaiters was covered with a dancing shadow pattern of thorn twigs, the light reaching him through a leafless intervening hedge, and the metallic curve of his sheep crook shone silver bright in the same abounding rays. He came up to the boundary fence, and stood to regain breath. It seemed as if the spot was unoccupied by a living soul. The fire was issuing from a long straw stack, which was so far gone as to preclude a possibility of saving it. A rick burns differently from a house. As the wind blows the fire inwards, the portion in flames completely disappears like melting sugar, and the outline is lost to the eye. However, a hay or a wheat rick, well put together, will resist combustion for a length of time if it begins on the outside. This before Gabriel's eyes was a rick of straw, loosely put together, and the flames darted into it with lightning swiftness. It glowed on the windward side, rising and falling in intensity, like the coal of a cigar. Then a superincumbent bundle rolled down, with a whisking noise. Flames elongated, and bent themselves about with a quiet roar, but no crackle. Banks of smoke went off horizontally at the back like passing clouds, and behind these burned hidden pyres, illuminating the semi-transparent sheet of smoke to a lustrous yellow uniformity. Individual straws in the foreground were consumed in a creeping movement of ruddy heat, as if they were nuts of red worms, and above shone imaginary fiery faces, tongues hanging from lips, glaring eyes, and other impish forms, from which at intervals sparks flew in clusters like birds from a nest. Oak suddenly ceased from being a mere spectator, by discovering the case, to be more serious than he had at first imagined. A scroll of smoke blew aside, and revealed to him a weak and startling juxtaposition with the decaying one, and behind this a series of others, composing the main corn produce of the farm, so that instead of the straw stack standing, as he had imagined, comparatively isolated, there was a regular connection between it and the remaining stacks of the group. Gabriel leapt over the hedge, and saw that he was not alone. The first man he came to was running about in a great hurry, as if his thoughts were several yards in advance of his body, which they could never drag on fast enough. Oh, man, fire, fire! A good master and a bad servant is fire, fire! I mean a bad servant and a good master, oh, Mark Clark, come! And you, Billy Smallberry, and you, Marion Money, and you, Jan Coggan, and Matthew there. Other figures now appeared behind this shouting man, and among the smoke, and Gabriel found that, far from being alone, he was in a great company whose shadows danced merrily up and down, timed by the jigging of the flames, and not at all by their owner's movements. The assemblage belonging to that class of society which casts its thoughts into the form of feeling, and... Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.